You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
The premise of this book is really powerful, which is that we're all afraid of things all the time in our lives, whether it's relationships or business or being in Afghanistan, potentially being shot at. And it's not about conquering the fear. It's about using that fear to even be more powerful.
And that's, I mean, that's one of the things I love about this book is that it really shows people that, like, fear is something we're going to live with for the rest of our lives. It's how we choose to deal with the fear is when you think of it even in happiness, right? It's like you're either going to let fear control your life or you're going to let it be a positive force for good. But I don't want to sound like I didn't have fear in those moments. The training does kick in. Like, we go through so much training, and when you're in those moments, we train to deal with that situation.
Right, and it's almost like a different kind of fear, because you know when that fear kicks in, these are the five things you have to do. It's like in your manual. And by the way, it's really brilliant, the process you come up with, and you really do teach people how to convert that fear into ways to move forward. Brandon, there are so many things I want to talk to you about with this new book, Mastering Fear. I at first wondered, welcome to the show once again, Brandon Webb, author of The Killing School. Author, what's that? We've done all of your books. Yeah. This is like your third time on the podcast. I've been on your podcast. You're author of the New York Times bestselling The Killing School, which is how you set up the actual school in the Navy SEALs, which teaches snipers. Yeah. Then you wrote The Red Circle about, you know, a lot of your experiences of your comrades in arms in among the SEALs and your adventures. And
well, that one was when my dad threw me out of the house, and that got me. That was my story of how I ended up in the SEAL teams.
Well, I'm going to get to that in this one, because you talk about it here as well. Yeah. This book is my personal favorite. You know why?
It's my favorite too, honestly.
It's I feel like there are so many things you say in here that during every single day I can, and I'll say the title saying, but every single day I can remind myself, oh no, Brandon mentioned this thing when this happens. And the book is called Mastering Fear. You detail so many stories. I mean, you've dealt with fear like, actually, let me just ask you this first question. You just, one of your first stories about yourself in the book is when you're in Afghanistan, and I couldn't quite picture graphically all the details. So you're with some of your buddies, not buddies, but other SEALs in Afghanistan, and there's like 50 Afghanistan guys kind of surrounding you, and they're not nice people to you. Yeah. And you talk about the premise of this book is not, oh, I could conquer fears, I could eliminate fears, I could, the premise of this book is really powerful, which is that we're all afraid of things all the time in our lives, whether it's relationships or business or being in Afghanistan, potentially being shot at. And it's not about conquering the fear, it's about using that fear to even be more powerful. It's almost like how in the book you quote Kamal talking about your superpowers. It's almost like how fear itself, you could turn it from making you into, you know, a sniveling person in the corner, unable to do something, into a superhero by channeling that fear. So I just explained that Afghanistan story.
It's why world records are broke in competition, not in practice. Like what story have we ever heard of a world record getting broken in a practice swim match or a running match?
I've wondered that. I've wondered, actually, when you see, like, Usain Bolt break a record in the Olympics. By the way, we're not avoiding Afghanistan. Just in case you were trying to change the topic.
Happy to talk about it.
when you see Usain Bolt break a record in the Olympics, a running record, is it that he never ran that fast practicing? And I always think he's, like, killing that score all the time and thinking, like, damn, why wasn't this in the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, it takes that pressure and anxiousness and, you know, which is a little bit of that fear and being able to recognize it and harness it to elevate your performance. And you know, I share a lot of personal stories of my own experience dealing with fear, and we all deal with it. And I think I'm in a position where I've had some interesting experiences as a kid and a childhood and then becoming a Navy SEAL, and I think the Navy SEALs are kind of maybe overly romanticized, and it's like, oh, these guys don't have any fear. And it's like, no, it's like everybody lives with fear. And so I felt like this book to me was, you know, and thank you to Kamal, who, you know, the inspiration behind the book was us having this experience teaching him how to swim and confront his fear of the water, which he'd had all his life.
Well, and that's what I thought was so great about the book. So it's almost a mistake for me to ask you about when people are potentially shooting at you, because that's like a cliche example of when someone quite correctly is afraid. But you interweave a lot of these stories with the story of our good mutual friend Kamal Ravikant, who's actually in the room right now, with Kamal was afraid to swim. He was afraid to learn how to swim.
Yeah.
And you taught him how to swim.
And afraid
of
the
water. Not by teaching him how to swim, but by teaching him what you describe throughout this book, which is how do you make fear work for you to drive you to new skills, new abilities, you know, ultimately to break down barriers inside of yourself, not to get rid of the fear, but to just have a more holistic life, a life worth living.
Yeah, and one thing about writing this book was, you know, and I wrote it with my writing partner, John. He said, okay, look, you've got all these great stories, but we got to like make this into a system. And I remember being a new instructor in the military. And when you teach a class for the first time, you really, really get into it and learn a lot more than you did before you started preparing to teach. And by getting into this writing process with Mastering Fear and developing this system, I actually learned some new stuff along the way myself. And I remember I was in Europe with my kids this summer. We had this massive issue with Facebook changing their algorithm. And the business that I run today is media publishing and e-commerce. And so we spent a lot of money on ads, on social media and performance marketing. Maybe it's hundreds of thousands of dollars a month on Facebook and we get a return. Well, Facebook shut us down. They labeled us as a gun seller. Don't sell guns. But they're like, they saw this military guys on one of our landing pages and they shut us down for almost a week. And we lost, you know, 3-4 days, almost a couple hundred thousand dollars in revenue. And I was, you know, you want to talk about being freaked out and scared. All this self-talk started coming into my head. You're going to lose your business. You're going to have to let go employees, all this stuff. And I'm dealing with this as I'm in Nice, France with my kids to watch the World Cup match. And I literally went back and I was like, okay, I got this system. And okay, where am I at in this process? And inserted myself in the system that I created with Mastering Fear. And I go, okay. And I just talked myself off the ledge. And I knew like the self-talk, I'm good at that. When the voices of doubt start chiming in, which we all have that self-talk.
But I want to ask you before the self-talk, when the first self-talk you were doing right then was the business is going to fail, I'm going to be living in out of my car or whatever you were thinking. Like I know that feeling too. When it feels like if your business goes down for one day, it feels like your business just declared bankruptcy. Like there's that, you can't help sort of projecting everything, the trend into the future, even if it's a 1 day trend or a 1 week trend. And I feel so bad, but it always brings me back to the worst moments in prior businesses. Like that's where the fear is coming from. And did you find that? Because you had a prior business, which you write about in the book, which blew up and you had to deal with the consequences. Did you feel in your body the way you felt in your body when that business was failing?
Yeah, I think that was the first emotion I felt and reaction. And then I said, wait a minute. I'm going about this wrong. I need to take my own advice, right? I just wrote this book on Mastering Fear. I said, let me look at everything and figure out what we can learn from this experience. Okay, one, we need to get better as a business on getting back to Google, hitting our email list, doing retargeting. Plus it showed me, give me the financials. I talked to my controller. I'm like, whoa, how do we let our margins slip this far? And because one of our products, the Crate Club, which is this James Bond box that we send out to men every month. It's like James Bond in a box. We had let our margins slip. And when you add like the cost of the customer acquisition cost against the product, I said this model isn't going to work long term. We need to get to 90-100% margin. And my team was like, "That's impossible." I was like, "No, it is possible. We have to make our own product." And so I realized that I talked to the team because my team was freaking out. We had to pay vendors 30-60 days out from already net 60. They're screaming at, you know, my ops guy, my controller is crying. I got him on the phone. I was like, look, everything is going to be okay. We have a good business. We have customers. It's a recurring revenue model. We have subscribers. If we had to eat Top Ramen for 30 days on the first of the month, we're going to get the rebills and we're flush with cash. So it's going to be okay. And we're going to get better as a business by going through this process. And they took a deep breath and like, oh my God, thank you for saying that.
So I mean, that almost reminds me of like whenever I get a letter from the IRS, I call my accountant and he says, don't worry, I'll call him, we'll take care of this. And he has this deep voice. And
I've got those letters too, they're terrible. As soon as I open that white envelope with IRS, my heart starts beating fast.
Yeah, no, that's fear. And now I've learned to channel that fear into calling my accountant instead of avoiding it and hiding the letter.
Just get it away.
So, did you kind of analyze what a worst case scenario would be? Because you don't talk about that much in the book, worst case scenario aspect.
In this case, for sure, I did worst case scenario and it wasn't that bad. And that's when I...
What was it?
I mean, worst case scenario, we got banned from Facebook and we couldn't recover. Then I had to look at, okay, what profit lines still generate revenue? And yeah, worst case, it was, I'm going to have to get rid of people. Like, I'm going to have to let people go and rebuild. But we still have a stable core business. And so I went to that worst case scenario and it wasn't that bad. And so I talked to the team and we talked about earlier about the tension of the arena and the performance, whether you're doing stand-up. I was like, this is where I told my team, this is an opportunity for us to kind of get smacked in the face and go, wake up, guys. Like, you know, look at what we're doing and how we can do it better across the board, not only with our marketing. And that was when I called my friend Nina, who runs all of Google Eastern Europe. I said, who's the best performance marketing agency out there? We have an in-house team, but we need more help. I got that set up. We just all started working as a team and we're now much better prepared for the future.
So there's a couple of things. There's a couple of things you describe there, which are almost precursors to your method of mastering fear. I mean, and you talk about them in the book as well, but this self-awareness aspect, like, okay, my mind's going crazy. I'm giving too much energy to the problem instead of the solution.
Yep.
And that's the average way people deal with fear, and that's the reason businesses go out of business and competitors don't win and stand-ups bomb and whatever. Relationships fail.
When I lost my first business, that's where I went. I had the conversation with my attorney and it was done, it was a huge weight off my shoulders. And then I started going into, oh my God, this is terrible. I lost all my money, I let my family down, my friends and family money. I'm gone. In fact, I owe people money.
What you just said is interesting. You said, I'm gone. Did you feel like, you know, you had put all of your self-worth in the value of this business? And since the value of the business was now zero, did you feel like you were worth zero?
Yeah. You feel worthless. But then I caught myself and I said, wait a minute. You used to be this guy that taught positive mental mindset in the sniper program. Time out. Let's look at the positives of this situation. The fact that I can, in that 3.5 years of starting the business and losing it, I'd raised with partners almost $4 million in capital. I've been at multiple meetings with banks and understand the SBA lending process. I know how to read financial statements. When I was first started the business, I had no idea how to read a P&L or a balance statement. It was intimidating to me. Now I look at it, I'm like, it's basic arithmetic, but it's very intimidating. And I was like, I went to business school along the way. I had all these skill sets. I said, I'm fine. Like, I can go to businessbroker.com or whatever it is, find a business that some baby boomer wants to get out of that's spitting off a couple hundred grand a year and scale it. You know, so I was, the moment I started, I made the decision to look at the positives of the situation rather than focus on the negative, which is just bringing me down. That was when I started to build up my self-image again and go, okay, I'm fine. Like, this is going to be okay. And, you know, I was practical about it. I had to go get a job. I ended up working for a division of L3 Communications, which was a great experience. Taught me I didn't want to be a corporate guy.
But then you had this just a few weeks ago or months ago when you had this problem with Facebook with your current business, you had this flashback to not only the fear, but probably that feeling of I'm a zero, I'm gone.
Yeah.
As you put it.
And that's one of the things I love about this book is that it really shows people that we are living, like, fear is something we're going to live with for the rest of our lives. It's how we choose to deal with the fear is what separates. It separates, really, when you think of it, even in happiness, right? It's like you're either going to let fear control your life or you're going to let it be a positive force for good. And that's a prime example of, I was having a great time in Europe. I have a good business. I have other sources of revenue. And when this happened, boom, I went to that place, but I caught myself and I said, I took my own advice, right? I literally was like, okay, no, I got to start thinking about this differently. And so I'm a Navy SEAL. People assume that, you know, I'm this fearless guy, and it's just not the case. Like, we all, regardless of, I've met some of the most successful people, from a guy, Scott Kelly, I mentioned in the book, who's an astronaut, test pilot, amazing guy. He was like, I was scared to apply for NASA. I didn't think I was good enough. And he said, I sorted through it and figured out that if I don't apply, the certainty is they'll never take me if I don't fill out the application. So It just shows you, like, some of the most successful people in the world, we all deal with this fear.
I'm just going to think about it in mathematical terms. It's like gravity. It's everywhere all the time, and it's how we deal with it. Yep. It determines whether we fall to the ground or, you know, figure out ways to fly, as being overly corny about it. But you can't avoid the fear that's everywhere. We're built with it. It's instinctive. We have tribal animals, primates had to have fear to survive in the jungle, and we have the same DNA still.
Yeah. One of the best books I've ever read is called The Tree of Knowledge by Umberto Maturana. And it's one of the hardest books I've ever read as well, because it's just a vocabulary that I had to literally read the book of the dictionary. But it talks about environment and fixed ideas and like how, like, even at a single cellular level, like, the environment changes, you know, cell structure. And it takes you on this beautiful journey of humanity and what it means to be human. But at the very end, they talk about people latching on to having a fixed mindset versus open mindset. So they have these fixed views of the world based on their experience. And not too long ago, it was commonly thought that the world was flat. And then it was, okay, well, the Earth doesn't rotate around the sun, right? Like, there's all these, like, very things that we take for granted today. They're like, oh, of course it's that way. But you were a kook to think that the world was anything other than this flat thing you're going to sail off the edge of in the boat. So when you translate that to fear, I tell the story of the jungle training where they had to eat, they showed you how to, like, trap monkeys to eat for survival, and how you trap a monkey in the Philippines. You dig a hole, you put something of value in there. In this case, it was the coconut. And you make these sticks in the hole, so the monkey sticks the hand in, grabs the coconut, but can't pull it out. And the thing is, the monkey won't let go of the coconut. All he has to do is let it go, and he's free. He won't let go. He's sitting there looking at the guy, the Filipino guy, coming to club him in the head and kill him, and he just still won't let go of this coconut. And I feel like I tell that story in there because the coconut is a lot of people's, they're holding on to these fears and these stories in their head. And one of the things I really respected about you when we met was you told the story and were vulnerable about how you were dealing with your own, confronting your fear of public speaking. And if you saw that, and then you made a conscious decision to let go and take the journey. And there's so many people that just don't do that, and they end up in these miserable relationships. They're in these careers where they thought at one point, oh, I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer, I'm going to make all this money. And then they get into these professions and they're absolutely miserable and they just won't let go.
Yeah. And they have excuses. They say, I can't. They don't say, okay, this is an opportunity. Like, I'm afraid to do public speaking. So this is an opportunity to figure out maybe 10 ways I can battle this fear and then just simply do them. And like you taught Kamal how to deal with his fear in swimming. It's almost like what you did was we'll get into it more in a little bit, but you created a very safe environment for him to be in the water without fear, and you build up from that in this particular case. But the biggest step for him, and the biggest step for you, and we're going to get back into your story about your business, is after all this self-talk and feelings of disaster happening, you made the decision, look, I'm not going to go down that path. I'm going to start thinking in terms of solutions instead of disasters. Yeah. So that decision is the first part of your process. But there's something else there. There's the self-awareness aspect that, oh, I see what's happening in my head. It's bad. I need to reverse it. Then there's positive self-talk. I did this, 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 this. I should be able to survive this. And meaning I should be able to come up with solutions once I switch my thinking, which you haven't done yet, I mean, in the process, but you're about to.
Yeah.
And then there's a third thing, which is really important, and you mentioned it briefly, actually, in the decision chapter. Surround yourself with wisdom, which is, I think, taken for granted. What you just said before when you were describing the business from a few months ago is one of the first things you did was you called your contact at Google.
Yeah.
So you called the second largest company in the world the person who decided your fate or fury, whatever you want to call it, and you said, give me advice, which is, I find to be a great technique. If someone is called and their advice is asked for, it kind of puts them off guard because you're giving them status. So no matter what they felt about you or your business before, it's now this, again, tribal thing. Like, oh, this person just gave me status. Okay, I'll help him out. And she did. And I think it's underestimated the power of preparing years or decades in advance for fear.
Yeah.
Because and that's by building up a network of wisdom, of people yep. who you can make those calls to no matter what the situation.
And you bring up a really good point about, and I talked about it earlier, about environment. Like our environment is so critical. And when I say that, I mean who you hang out with, like your friends, your even sometimes your family. There's been many situations where I've had conversations with my kids who are around family members that are just not in good places. And I remember last Christmas I rented a house in Lake Tahoe. It's a family tradition. We go skiing every year. And there was a member of the family that my kids, I know they feel a certain way about, and I understand because they're very negative. They get around, they just talk down to other people, and they don't even realize they're doing it. And I said, look, I had sat my kids down. I said, look, we know this. Here's the thing. It's much harder to be kind than clever. So for one, I don't want to hear any smart back talk. The other thing is just remove yourself from the environment. Just tell the person, look, I really don't want to get into this conversation now, and excuse yourself and leave the environment. Because being around those kind of people that are negative, and today in the world of social media, it's so important as well to curate that environment. So you surround yourself with people who are positive and loving and are going to amplify what you do and the person that you want to become.
And I'm always going to interrupt. I'm sorry. And I also know we have a tight time frame, but I want to point out in your book, there's two interesting anecdotes. One is someone who wants to start a business, but specifically disconnects from her family for a little while because she knows they'll be negative about her starting a business. And this has happened to me so many times where I've had to...
Yeah, that's Maria, I think.
Yeah, I kind of have in those situations a one strike and you're out policy, which is very hard because I talk to a lot of people about this who say the exact same thing. They have the exact same problem. And a lot of people say, well, 6 years ago, this person helped me move when I was down and out, so I have to be loyal back. And I'm like, yeah, but now is now. You have to be able to build your career, and they're off in their own toxicity, and yeah. they're not asking for your help, and they're just bringing you down. You have to have some policy of eliminating toxic people. The other thing you say, which is related to this, is you quote Paulo Coelho, author of The Alchemist, and you say, you know, haters are just confused admirers. So what I take from that in terms of action is, okay, you're a hater, which means you're a confused admirer. The only way I'm going to get you not confused anymore is if I go off and do something, and then you could admire what I do. Because I'm not going to, you can't ever logically change someone's mind. You can't argue with anybody because yeah. they're not going to change their opinion because their hand is on the coconut.
Yeah, I remember Mark Harmon, who's one of the most successful TV actors ever of NCIS. He has a production company called Wings. Him and I were working on a TV project together and got to be friends because his father was in the military. His father was a Heisman Trophy winner at Michigan and left a professional football career to join the Army Air Corps and was a bomber pilot in World War II, then went on to fly one of my favorite planes, the P-38 Lightning, over China. And his dad just had this amazing story. And Mark and I kind of bonded over that. And Mark was a guy that was the quarterback at UCLA and had a career that he could have went immediately into the NFL. He left and he wanted to act. And I was really struggling. It was the first time I was getting a little bit of success and limelight. And I had former teammates coming out on social media trying to tear me down and hate. And I saw it. I knew what it was. Like, I was like, okay, that guy over there, he's the guy I kicked out for cocaine and he's out of the community. This guy got kicked out for performance. So I knew they were just unhappy people and what it was, but what bothered me was that, you know, the confused 15-year-old admirer. Like, why would this guy say this? He was this guy. But Mark just sat me down and he was like, look, I'm going to share some personal stories with you about what people would say to me when I'm in a huddle at UCLA. The stuff that they would call my dad a coward and say all this stuff. And he just told me, he's like, look, you really have to be careful in who you hang out with and surround yourself with good people and realize that anyone that takes the time out of their day to trash talk somebody, like energy into it, and I'm talking like on social media, wherever, that person, like there is no happy, successful person in life that has the time to do that kind of thing. And you just got to recognize that and hang out.
I'm going to steal that line from you, by the way.
And hang out with the right kind of people. And that's why, I mean, I love hanging out with Kamal and I love hanging out with you. It's like I built this really great network of friends and people that and family that I hang around with and I love. And I know that we're all dealing with shit.
Right.
But it's like a positive support system. You know?
And to do this process of mastering fear and, let's say, turning it into a superpower, I do feel like there are these precursor skills. Like, the self-awareness to identify that negative self-talk and turn it into positive. The listing positive attributes that kind of boost you up again. The fact that you are in a constant process of networking. And I'm a horrible networker, but I always try to, and I know you do this too, I always try, even when there's a small opportunity, to do a favor. Not because I expect future favors back, but because that's in part how you build up this room of wisdom around you, you know, when you need it. And it's at that point when you have kind of like your wisdom board and your positive self-talk and your self-awareness, then you can make the decision, which is the first part of your process that you describe. I'm going to deal with this fear. Like Kamal, when he's, you know, when he first comes to you, it's not that he says, oh, I can't do it because this is, he's like, you told him, show up at the swimming pool. He made a decision. Okay, I'll be there. And he did it. And that's the decision. So we all have to come up with this decision. That's the first part of your process. And you exemplified it with how you dealt with this catastrophe in your company. I want to now go back to almost the cliche example of fear when someone's about to shoot you, because I was just really curious about this one scene, so I have to keep asking about it. A bunch of guys who basically want to kill you start getting closer and closer. Why didn't they just shoot you?
That situation was...
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Why didn't they just shoot you?
That situation was, we were in Afghanistan.
2002.
And, yeah, 2002. This might even have been right up into 2000. I think it was either right before Christmas or right after Christmas. Either 2001 Christmas or, Happy New Year. You're in Afghanistan. Go chase bad guys in the mountains. So we were on this mission that was supposed to be a one-day mission. We were going to take some Marines with us, chopper in, get off. The Marines would set this perimeter up on this valley, and we would go, so we could go inside and clear this cave complex. That was, they called it, what was it called? I think it was Tarnak Farms 2 or something. It was two main training camps in Afghanistan. One was in Kandahar, The other one was up north, and this one had been was strategically bombed. We went in right after to do like a battle damage assessment and see if there's any bad guys. So we're in there, and we just started finding all sorts of stuff. We were in these caves. We're finding like American radios with crypto on it, you know, left like stuff that was like we had given to our allies that ended up in Afghanistan. It was just crazy stuff. So we started finding all this intelligence, and we would call it back and report it back to headquarters. And then we ended up literally, I remember, this is like another lesson that has nothing to do with fear, but I remember this big explosive ordnance disposal guy. His name was Steve. He was this big bodybuilder guy. And he was, we had these EOD guys along so we could blow our way through doors if we needed to. So we had all these charges, and some charges are, we use water because it, the force of water push. We had all this extra water bottles just like this. We had called for the extraction. We're at the extraction point. You could hear the H-53 helicopters, which is a massive helicopter. You could hear the like whoop, whoop, whoop of the blades. The sun's going down, and then I remember the Captain Harwood at the time was in charge of the Tactical Operations Center. He basically said, you guys aren't coming home. We're, I need you out. You're going to stay out there and continue to exploit the intelligence.
Well, we meaning had, because why were these Afghanistan guys having so much, why do they have so much American equipment on them?
Yeah, equipment, there was all sorts of, like, we were finding other activities and reporting on it. He's like, you guys need to stay out there. There's still, like, a lot of stuff going out. Just stay out there. So as, I remember, I saw Steve taking his water and just, like, pouring it out because he didn't want to carry the weight anymore. He's like, oh, the choppers are coming. I'm going to pour out the water. And I'm like, I was like, hey, man, give me that. So I filled up all my canteens. Because I know, like, hydration is everything. So I drank, like, 3 bottles, topped off all my water bottle. And then I'm like, okay, I'm good. I'm full up, you know, ready player one. And the helicopters get called off. And Steve is, like, pouring out the last of his water. And he realized what he had done. I'm like, you idiot. Like, we're in the middle of nowhere. And you're pouring out good water. And he had to literally, so we end up being out there for, I think it was over 10 days. And, you know, there's Steve at the Afghan well, like with a little purification tablet, which tastes like hell, like dropping it in there, having to drink this crap water. So the lesson learned there is don't prepare for the extract until it happens, right?
Well, again, it's always like prepare. Keep in mind the worst case scenario has some reasonable probability.
Yeah, don't count the chickens before they hatch. Don't count your money before the check's in the bank, all that stuff.
Which happens all the time. Like, you, how many times have you been in a sales deal and they're like, oh, of course, we love this. We'll send you the contract tomorrow. And then you never hear from them again.
Yeah. I mean, this amazing story about the Beats story, right? When Beats sold to Apple for whatever $1 billion. I forget the partner involved, but he's like, just don't say any.
Jimmy Iovine said to Dr. Dre.
It just says to Dre.
Dr. Dre says to everyone, we just sold Apple.
Yeah, he's like, just shut up for the weekend. Let it happen. And
wait, hold on a second. Jay, are you serious? We actually have 10 minutes?
Yeah.
So, and then it's some video ends up on social media of them celebrating and saying, yeah, we're billionaires, blah, blah, and it almost killed the whole deal, right? But to get to your story, so that's the background. So now we're in there, and we get at night, the C-130 gunship, which patrols this kill box, had killed a couple guys, and they said, hey, we need you to go out there pre-dawn and check it out. And so we got the GPS coordinates. We had a squad, which I think we had 7 guys with us. We went and patrolled out there. We set up right at the GPS coordinate, which was in this kind of valley, and we laid up, you know, kind of concealed ourselves, and our chief and a couple guys went. We set the perimeter. They went to kind of look for the bodies. And the sun had just started coming up, and then I spot these guys in the cave, and they
started, in the cave.
They were coming. It was about probably 500 meters away, and they started coming out of the cave, and you could hear talking, and then they were praying. You could hear the prayer, and so I I looked at Cassidy, who was our platoon commander, who is now in charge of the whole NASA astronaut program. Was the second Navy SEAL astronaut. I got Cassidy. I signaled him, and we called on the radio to the guys that were out there to get down. And then we noticed that they had seen us, but they're too far away to really give effective fire. And they probably couldn't. We were hunkered in, so they saw something, but the situation is starting to escalate. The sun's up. We're in it. They're elevated. We're down here, which is never a good
position. Did they try firing?
We had an exchange of fire start happening, you know, just like a small exchange. And
as people do.
Yeah. And then I remember we had, because we were just planning on this one mission, I didn't have my full sniper kit. Normally I have a laser range finder, sniper rifle. We have to call in an airstrike and I have to guesstimate. So Chris, my platoon commander, looks to me and says, "Hey, I need a range and bearing to target." He's got the B-52 on the radio, and I'm going, "Okay, maybe I'm going to guess a little bit long on this first drop." So I want to guess short. We're already dropping danger close to us. Like a 500 meter drop is pretty close, and to the point where Cassidy had to give permission. He had to give his social security number to the aircraft to authorize a danger close drop, because we're practically dropping these bombs on ourselves. And so all this is happening. And then 60 seconds to impact, we hear a baby crying because these bad guys had their families with them. So that was a pretty heavy moment. As a guy, I was like about to have his own son while I was deployed to Afghanistan. The burst bomb drops. It drops a little long. You know, I think we get maybe half of them. We call up, second bomb takes out everybody. But it was pretty intense. Like it started out as everything is okay. I see these guys. We're taking the wreck action. Well, then we realize they see us, and then things start to escalate. Thank goodness we had the radio guys call, and we had the contact with the aircraft. And then it was okay, but it was like, you know, it escalated pretty quickly. And so,
like, how on a scale of 0 to 10, how scared were you?
I wasn't scared in the moment. I got like that anxious. I was more scared afterwards because I'm like, man, that was intense. Like if that hadn't gone, that could have gone way bad for us. And I think, yeah, I mean, I had a couple near-death experiences in Afghanistan where it's like you realize after the fact, okay, wow, that was intense. But I don't want to sound like I didn't have fear in those moments. The training does kick in. Like we go through so much training, and when you're in those moments, we train to deal with that situation.
Right, and it's almost like a different kind of fear because you know when that fear kicks in, these are the five things you have to do. It's like in your manual.
Yeah.
But like a business failing, every business fails in its own unique way, else you would have had the experience to make it succeed and not fail.
Yeah.
So that kind of fear, like I wanted to ask you, I was just curious while reading the book. And by the way, because we're not going to go through your whole process of mastering fear, but it's really brilliant the process you come up with, and you really do turn fear in so many different situations, whether it's relationships or business or teaching someone a hard skill or learning a hard skill. You teach people how to convert that fear into ways to move forward. And we'll maybe still get to some of those. But I was curious, going completely other end of the spectrum from being in Afghanistan, how old were your kids when you got divorced?
Oh, I think Hunter was 7. Olivia was 5. And you know, Grayson was 2.
You know, the 7-year-old and the 5-year-old, you would read them stories to sleep at night. Did they ever have a nightmare and, you know, you would go downstairs and see what the nightmare was about and comfort them?
Oh, yeah. No, I remember, this is a funny story. I was in my house and I was writing. I'd sold an article to FHM magazine. It was when I first started writing, and I had a Heineken. I remember I was sitting in my chair, I was writing on my laptop, I had my Heineken. I put my Heineken down because I heard Olivia's. She was crying from her bedroom. So I go back in there. I go and I comfort her. She's having a nightmare. I walk out. My beer is flipped over. And I was like, man, that thing was 3/4 full and it's gone. There's not a big mess. I'm like, okay, that doesn't. I go in the fridge. I get another Heineken. And I come out. And then I see my 2-year-old son, Grayson, walking around. And he's got this like swagger.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, he drank the beer. You know, 2 years old. So I get on my, I called my friend.
Very prodigious children.
Yeah. I think it was Glenn or Eric, one of my medic buddies in the SEAL team. Like, hey, this happened. He's like, hey, just keep an eye on him. As long as he's, you know, he's doing this, he's like, you should be okay.
So again,
I had to tell my wife, your source of wisdom,
you called. Yeah. When you had a little fear. But what I was going to get to was, when you're going through a divorce, you realize one of the things you're not going to be around those kids ever again in the same way. It's not going to be like when they're going to school, you're with them those 250 days of the year straight.
And I actually think this is a great topic and people don't talk about divorce and family enough because it's just like this elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about it. And I feel like especially judged because I don't live with my kids full time. I don't know what your arrangement is.
I don't live with my kids full time. My kids are with... They were just with me for different amounts of weeks, and this is their last week with them, and so maybe that's why I was thinking of this. But I just want to mention when I read about your divorce and the kids, one thing I was thinking was when I got divorced, the thing I was afraid of the most, and this really almost incapacitated me, was that I would not be able to be there when they woke up in the middle of the night having a nightmare.
Yeah.
Probably never going to happen again.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, it could happen when they were staying with me, but it's a random event, so it may never happen again. And I wonder if that was a thought, a fear.
When I divorced, I was coaching Little League and enjoyed it. I had this vision of fatherhood for the future and we were in marriage counseling. And when we decided to end the relationship, and it was really her. I was holding on to it. I didn't want to be a failure. And we decided, thankfully, we had a great lady we were working with that really helped us have a good divorce and befriend, build and work at a friendship that we have a strong bond today. But I was afraid I'd just lost this whole vision of what I thought being a dad was going to be like and was in an empty house alone by myself having to have the conversations with the neighbors. Where's your wife? Where's your kids?
Yeah, those shameful conversations.
Yeah, having to bump into the Little League commissioner. Hey, are you coaching this year? So I had to deal with all that stuff.
And again, that feeling of, I'm not, they could be having a nightmare tonight and I'm not going to be able to comfort them.
Yeah, or they get bullied at school and I'm not going to be there. So, you know, I would, and, you know, our situation was unique. My wife at the time had a good family support system. They had this beautiful ranch in Northern California. She's like, I want to go up there. And she was dealing with stuff. And the psychologist we were working with said, look, you know, happy mom, happy kids. You got to support her in this. And I was like, no, the law says this. You know, you can't move out of the county. But I made peace with it. And then over time, we built this amazing relationship to the point where even the in-laws kind of take sides in the beginning, but we started setting the example and both our sets of parents kind of fell in. And today I get text messages from my former mother-in-law, like congratulations on the new book. So we have this like amazing relationship.
So when you're first going through it though, and you're like, you feel this palpable loneliness, particularly because you know, you're torn away from your children for the first time. Maybe I'm dramatizing it too much, but how did you tell yourself, okay, I'm going to deal with this fear, and then what was the jumping off point? Jumping off is part of your process in dealing with fear. What was your jumping off point where you're like, okay, my relationship with my kids are going to be different, but it's going to be great. I'm going to make it great in my own way.
Yeah, that was it. I don't know, remember what moment it was, but that was the catalyst, right? I realized, okay, my relationship with my kid has changed. My idea of what fatherhood is in the future has changed. How do I have a positive how do I create this into a positive and make it the best situation possible? And so I came up with a plan. We decided, look, for stability, let's not do this back and forth stuff. They'll be with you. You'll be with your family on your family's ranch, which helps us, you know, that she had a beautiful house to stay in Paso Robles. And we just decided, okay, this is how we're going to, we're going to have a co-parenting relationship in the future. And I would get the kids in the summer and we'd have a winter holiday. And so I said, I'm going to build a tradition of adventure in the summer. And then we're going to take this family ski trip in the winter. And I taught the kids from nothing into expert skiers. My daughter's on the ski race team this year in high school. So I created this tradition and, you know, we FaceTime and we have our way, and it's a very positive environment. And their mom got remarried, had two more daughters. Her husband's a great guy. He's a chiropractor up in Oregon. And I literally have the kind of relationship where it was not last Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving before. I have an investment property in Oregon. I went up there and I said, look, how about I just cook dinner, Thanksgiving dinner for everybody? So all her family came over, her husband, and I cooked Thanksgiving dinner, and we're like, you know, sharing stories. That's a kind of relationship I have. And
so again, it's this focus on always being self-aware when, I mean, and this is what we just talked about, was not necessarily fear, but also depression. Your same process applies. And like the process itself is, let me find where I bookmarked it. The process itself is decision, coming to the decision of dealing with the fear, rehearsal, kind of, I guess, getting in safe scenarios where you could encounter the fear, but you know very deeply it's not going to harm you. Letting go, really deciding that, okay, I'm gonna feel the fear and I'm going to somehow sit with it and figure out new ways to deal with it. Jumping off, where now you have to really come up with a long-term plan of dealing with the fear or the depression or whatever. And then what I think is the most important, what you say is the most important, is knowing what matters.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was reading in your book about knowing what matters, I was thinking, boy, this is going to be great. I'm going to get in this podcast and I'm going to say, that reminds me of Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, the stories you're telling. And then like the very next page, it's just like Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. So I'm like, oh, Brandon thought of it. But knowing what matters is, I mean, that's how Viktor Frankl, as an example, survived, the worst concentration camps in World War II, and so many people didn't. That's how knowing what matters, like your kids in this case, allows you to go all the way back and make the decision, I need to deal with this fear.
Yeah.
I need to figure out how to let go, how to jump off, because what matters to me is my family. I think that's such an important, also, precursor skill.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of the, I mean, the reason I put it at the end, because it's so important, and I see so many people, and you probably experience this too, they go, James, I want to be rich. And you're like, okay, what's rich? What's the number? They don't even know what the number is.
Right. And you bring up the point, like you turn a lot of kind of self-help advice upside down, but you bring up the point that it's BS to say money's not important, because obviously it is important.
Yeah.
If you could do a lot of things with money, you know, hopefully good, unfortunately some bad, but hopefully people listening to this do good things with it. And you can enjoy life. You can pursue your passions more if you have some money. And that's why we're all trying to succeed and build careers and so on. But fear, you know, just going for money will never get you there. Because if you're competing against, let's say you're building your media business, the media business you have right now. Let's say you had no, and the topic is roughly what you've been doing all your life, which is relating to, you know, the things you studied and learned and experienced as a Navy SEAL. Like you said, this James Bond crate box is one of your products. You're passionate about that because you have been for 30 years. If your competitor is someone who's not so passionate but is focused on making $50 million, you're going to crush him. Because passion, I feel, create, and tell me if I'm wrong, passion creates nuance. It creates an understanding of nuance because you're able to see in between the small crevices that the other people who are, they're capped where the money is, and you're capped where much higher where your passion is.
Yeah, I mean, our biggest competitor in that kind of monthly gear subscription box, and ours is the Crate Club. We went in to the market because I saw, I'm like, oh, these guys aren't passionate about this. Like the number one guy is the box is full of crap. It's like nothing against manufacturing in China, because China has a lot of good manufacturing capability. My iPhone is made in China. But a lot of the gear stuff that's made in China is, you know, it fits the stereotype where it's just kind of crappy. And I could tell there was no passion and pride behind the product that we're sending out. And they were the biggest one. And it took us only, I think, a year and a half to go from number three to number one in category.
But that's why also when you experience this almost catastrophe, you're able to say as a solution, let's make our own product. Someone who's just an NBA looking at spreadsheets is not going to say, let's create our own James Bond-like gadgets, because they don't know how. They didn't have the pleasure of studying these things and experiencing it. You did. So you're able to say, okay, well, if we use this part, you're able to kind of design your own way to make a product. You know all the manufacturers. You're passionate about it. You know what matters. And so when fear hit you on this business, you're able to come up with so many, almost an exponential number of solutions to conquer that fear. Just like, you know, the story starts off, you're teaching our friend Kamal how to swim. You teach him in a very unusual way how to swim. And it's, again, it's not teaching him a swimming technique, it's teaching him a battling fear technique.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Studying what you did there applies to every area of life, whether it's business or stand-up comedy. When you go out into the audience and you tell a joke and they're totally silent, that's scary.
Yeah.
And you have to know what matters to you there, and you have to do this process of, okay, decision, rehearsal, letting go, jumping off, knowing what matters, and then you can get you get the experience to build up, to turn those situations, those tense situations, into good ones. Because tension is energy, and you can either use that energy to blow up,
yeah,
or you could use that energy to blow up in a good way, like to be enormous.
Yeah.
And I know you have to wrap. I just want to say this is a book I'm going to use every single day. Again, your process of decision, rehearsal, letting go, jumping off, knowing what matters. It's almost good we didn't get to everything, because people should buy the book and understand what each thing means and follow all the stories, because it's not just about avoiding bullets. It's about learning to swim, dealing with relationships, succeeding in building an 8, 9, 10 figure business. So many great stories you have. It's a short book. It's easy to read. Brandon's looking at it right now that I'm holding my copy. Every other page is bookmarked. I didn't even know what to do. At the end, I was bookmarking every single page. I just should have stopped bookmarking, and I ruined the book because there's so many pages folded over. I have an idea for a part two for this, whenever you can come back, which is I want to see if your process held true, which I think it did, for every single thing I've been afraid of.
Yeah.
Like, I've been afraid of going broke. You've mentioned me, thank you, by the way, in this book several times. Going broke, dealing with relationships, throwing out all my belongings, even doing stand-up. And I was scared to death each time, and I always thought I had to conquer my fear, but really almost like immersing yourself in it, like accepting the challenge is where the superpower begins. And that's what people will get out of this book, is building that superpower. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, as always.
Yeah,
always a good conversation.
We're definitely, you promise we're going to do a part two?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.